Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, we're back. We're going to talk to Kevin Allison from the Risk Podcast and the State Comedy Troupe, which you can see episodes of on Hulu. We talk about his Vipassana meditation retreat. He got back, and then the next day came over so we get a fresh brain perspective. All right, before we get right to it, this episode is brought to you by Future Moments, makers of apps for content creation. Check them out on the Apple App Store, MicSwap, AudioMaster, and AudioFix for videos. We use the apps for this podcast. That's why it sounds so good. All right, the music behind me is my old band, Setting Sun. As always, I hope you enjoy this conversation with me and Kevin Allison. I might play along with the intro today because I'm feeling it. All right, hit it. Hit it.
G, 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 take me away. G, 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 take me today.
All right. Well, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Welcome back, meaning from many places. Welcome back here and 10 days of silence. How long have you been back from Vipassana for now?
I came back on Sunday.
Today's Tuesday.
Yeah. So yesterday, Monday, was my first day back in the real world dealing with, you know, work and all that sort of thing. I chose to do something that I think the organization, the Vipassana retreat people, would frown on from the very beginning.
There's a lot of codes of conduct.
Yes. I'd love to talk about your thoughts and feelings about all of it. But before I went on the retreat, I determined that I would do mushrooms. On my 11th day, on the day that I returned home to my apartment.
Okay. You made that promise to yourself.
Yes. I had, you know, one of the things is I do microdosing of LSD. I do small bits of LSD once every 3 days, about, 18 micrograms of LSD once every 3 days. And the thing about, if you ever want to have a big trip on hallucinogens, if you ever want to have it, then you have to take some time off from the microdosing.
To get your tolerance up.
Right, yeah. Right, exactly. So I thought this would be an ideal occasion to do that. I happened to have a source who had these liquid mushrooms. It's not a tincture, I'm not sure what it is, but he had a gave me a bunch of little bottles of this stuff, and I was like, I think I'll take two of them. So two times a normal mushroom trip on my 11th day.
But you were going to wait till you got home.
I was going to wait till I got home. Smart. Yeah, and had that kind of plan. What I actually planned when I went on the retreat is, we'll see how I feel on the 11th day.
That sounds much more reasonable.
Yeah. The plan was, once I get home, we'll see if I still think that's a good idea to take mushrooms.
Yeah.
And in my experience, it was. But I'm getting ahead of it. Why don't we go back to the beginning? The reason I went on this retreat to begin with was that you and I had a conversation, I don't know if it was a year ago or 2 years ago. I think it was 2 years ago.
Where we initially had the conversation about it.
Yeah. We were having dinner. It was a bunch of people who work for RISC, right? Yeah. And at that time, I had started doing transcendental meditation.
Right.
I had started doing 20 minutes of TM in the morning and 20 minutes of TM at around 4 or 5 in the afternoon. And if people don't know what that is, transcendental meditation is when you repeat a mantra, a word or a couple of syllables over and over and over again silently in your mind. And, you know, there are all sorts of well-known people who are huge proponents of it. David Lynch is very, very big proponent of it. What I had found after doing TM for about, I don't know, 9 months or so, was that it was calming.
Yeah.
It was giving my brain a chance to be off its beaten path of running around all over the place.
I know what you're going to say. It doesn't go as deep as Vipassana.
Right. It was, well, you know, I had no, literally no idea what Vipassana was until it was introduced on the fourth day of this 10-day retreat. I thought I knew what it was.
Now, I'm here assuming. We didn't talk at all about it. So when you came in, I'm assuming you had a good time. But before you got here, I'm like, maybe he had a horrible time.
Oh, you know, I had a little bit of both. What you said to me that night when we were first talking about it, I think it was two years ago. I think it was a Christmas dinner for RISC. And you said, I highly recommend you give this a try because this is, you know, going to a whole other level as far as meditation goes. And you said, now you might end up hating me for having recommended it. You might end up hating me halfway through, or you might end up hating me, you know, at the very end.
Are you here to hurt me? Oh boy.
Well, here's the thing. I now would highly recommend this retreat to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I will say pretty much the exact same thing you said to me. You know, what I didn't quite comprehend until it was completely over was that discomfort and
physical discomfort or mental?
All kinds of discomfort. Yeah. Of feeling challenged and outside your comfort zone is a very important part of the whole thing. There are aspects of the retreat that are deliberately kind of upsetting, I think, you know, or at least upsetting compared to how we normally live our lives.
Well, there's so many aspects of our normal lives that you have to sacrifice to just even be there, let alone doing the work of the meditation.
Yes.
No
yes.
cell phones, no books, no anything, pen or paper.
Right. And no speech.
No sexual thoughts, no masturbation.
Well, here's, now, you know, that is a big thing that I want to talk about is, did they present it to you, when you say no sexual thoughts, did they say that to you? Did they word it that way?
It's on the list of code of conducts for while you're there. Not code of conducts while you're always practicing, but just for the 10 days that you're there.
Right. Well, of course,
I guess on the 11th day, you're free to have sex with everyone.
Well, so how long ago did you do it?
I did my 10-day in like 2002.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. And for anyone who doesn't know, this is through the website is dhamma.org. That's dhamma.org.
Totally free.
It's completely free. It's the students who take this 10-day silent retreat donate because, you know, it meant so much to them. And of course, you know, they've got a lot of rich benefactors as well. But it's completely free.
Non-religious, non-secular.
Well, that is another thing that I think is
questionable.
Yeah. Really? I think that you know, there are the whole thing is presented by this guy named S.N. Goenka, right? Yep. Who a Burmese man who has passed away. He passed away in 2013.
Mm-hmm. Recently.
And so you are actually, throughout this entire 10 days, listening to audio recordings of him. And then at nighttime, when it's time for the discourses, for, you know, an hour of him talking, watching a video of him. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's just these assistant teachers who are there to answer your questions if you have private questions about how your meditation practice is going.
Which I thought was really important, so the whole practice doesn't go rogue.
That
would happen, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. You know, like, there are certain rules. For example, you have to wake up every morning at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Is that for the morning meditation before the food?
That is correct.
There's an optional. That's kind of optional, right?
Well, no. I mean, here's the thing. They word it in the directions that you can do it in your own room.
That's what I did.
you know, to me, it was interesting because that was one of the three areas in which I found myself failing and struggling. Or failing, struggling, fighting, you know, battling. It was the 4 o'clock. For the first 7 days, I got up at 4 o'clock in the morning and was pretty good about it. I was just like, I'm a good boy. I'm following the rules, et cetera, et cetera. Now, as the days went by, I noticed I would go up to the meditation hall where, you know, where everyone gathers, right? Like it says, yes, you have the option of doing it in your room, but I'm like, what's the point of getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning if you're not going to show up? You know what I mean? Like, if you're going to just stay in your room, you could just as easily fall back asleep, right? Or at least I would tend to, I think. So I would show up in the meditation hall.
I did it because it was the only time I had where I wasn't surrounded by people.
Ah.
Because my cabin would empty out and then it would just be me there. And I'd be like, this is just what I needed.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Nice. Yeah. So you were actually in cabins back then. They didn't even have like a men's residence completely set up yet.
I did mine in California.
Oh, I see. I see. Okay, great.
I was living in Los Angeles.
Yeah. There are a bunch of these meditation houses that do the same retreat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All over the world. So you didn't share a cabin with other people?
I shared a room with one man. Okay. But it was a pretty nice residence hall, you know, from what I understand, Goenka says that the ideal thing is that everyone would have their own room eventually, that you know, that's the goal of to build toward that. But for now, everyone shares with one roommate, but it's a decent bed.
This is the one in North Fork, Massachusetts?
In Shelburne Falls,
yeah. Okay.
So, I did have a roommate, and I was very conscious of the fact that he was a very good boy. You know, when I say very good boy, I mean, he was very much following the directions.
Yeah.
He was very good about sitting up straight and, like, you know, I always had a little bit of an eye on him because he was my roommate, you know.
But like, you didn't ever make eye contact? No nonverbal communication?
No, we had a conversation for about 20 minutes or a half hour before it all started, because that's when we were arriving and getting into the room. And then we talked plenty on day 10. On day 10, when you're allowed to start talking again, you know, they release you at a certain point in that day.
So you had talked to him beforehand, so you kind of had a sense of...
Yeah, I had a sense that he was a really nice guy and that he had more meditation experience than I did and that he was really intending to go hard at this, even though he'd never learned Vipassana before.
Right.
Yeah, like going back to what you were saying before. So this fella, Goenka, he's a Burmese fellow. He was a successful businessman, banker, I think, in, you know, whatever, the 40s or 50s or something like that in Burma. Had migraines, went all over the world to doctors, tried to get the migraines fixed, no one could do anything. Then a friend told him, look, there's this guy in Burma, in your hometown, who teaches a form of meditation which is so pure and exact to the instructions that Buddha, that, you know, Siddhartha Gautama, right, laid out, that 90% of the Buddhist world doesn't follow, has lost sight of how to do this particular meditation. Now, if that's, I'm sure that scholars of Buddhism might argue with what I just described, but that's the way it's kind of presented to you, that, hey, we've got the pure, real way to do it that the man himself laid down 2,500 years ago, and we are going to show you how to do it quite strictly.
Right. When I hear that kind of stuff, I immediately get defensive and my suspects go up.
Yes.
Because I'm sure everyone's like, oh, this is the best. This is the pure way.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. There are, and you are even told at a certain point, there are other people who call other forms of meditation vipassana. That's not quite the same thing, which is pretty much what you find in Buddhism with all kinds of meditation. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it does feel pure to me because it doesn't involve anything but your own breath. It's like the simplest practice to practice.
Well, the first 3.5 days were what you just described.
Yeah.
What's called anapana or anapara. It's focusing only on the breath.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets more specific as the days go by. At first, it's just focus on your breath.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's focus on all the sensations going through your nostrils and what the area around your face where breath might be happening. Then on the third day, it's now focus just on the area between the rim of your nostrils and the top of your upper lip,
mm-hmm,
and just on the actual physical sensations that are occurring because of the breath. In other words, itchiness, swelling, coolness, contraction, whatever physical sensations you're feeling in that like quarter inch of an area of your face,
which is happening to us all every day,
right?
And we're not noticing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then on the fourth day,
mm-hmm,
there's a big change, and that is when Goenka introduces everyone to Vipassana. It turns out that what you were doing in those first 3.5 days,
mm-hmm,
was training yourself to become more aware,
right,
of physical sensation in a specific area, to laser focus your brain on physical sensation on a particular area of your
all
body.
All a buildup. It's like your awareness muscle is just starting to be worked out.
Yes. Because then on day 4, when he introduces you to Vipassana, he says, you know, here's the way Buddha really wanted you to meditate, was to take a little frame, almost like the circle of light that might come out of a flashlight or the frame of a movie camera, and to focus it on a particular little part of your body. He starts at the top of the head. So, for example, you could start right at the very center of the top of your head and start focusing on what are the physical sensations there.
Mm-hmm.
Swelling, itching, tingling.
But don't react to them.
But don't react. Mm-hmm. That is the key thing. That what you start to do as you go through the meditation, you spend an hour or an hour and a half just taking that circle of awareness or that frame of awareness and moving it gradually over your entire surface of your body.
Mm-hmm.
And you come to blind spots. For me, always the first big blind spot were the shoulders, where I'm just like, it's numb. I'm not feeling any. I might as well be dead zone there or anesthetized or something. You got to wait and wait and wait. And then, okay, I feel a little tingling or something there. And then you move down, you know. And then you go down to the feet and then back up to the head and then down to the feet and, you know, covering the whole body.
I always wondered if that tingling sensation you start to feel is just the bugs that are crawling all over your skin.
I did wonder, like, what the hell would they do if they had a bed bug infestation? Oh, my God.
I'm so aware on the first day. All this tingling.
But yeah, apparently the point, the main point of it all, mm-hmm. is that non-reaction. Is
observing.
Yeah.
Don't quantify it with a reaction.
Exactly. Don't be pissed off mm-hmm. if you can't feel anything in your shoulder. Don't be thrilled if you've got wonderful tingling in your shoulder. Mm-hmm. Don't be annoyed if you've got a terrible pain in your back from having sat for an hour and a half.
Just observe.
Yes. Yeah.
Did his singing ever get on you?
Well, my God, Gary. Now, that is an example right there of one of the mindfucky things that I think there is about the whole thing.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Like, tell me this thing.
You have to listen to hours of this man singing.
Yeah.
In ancient Pali, the words of Buddha. And the funny thing about ancient Pali is it is an old dead language, and most of the sounds are just like
it's like you're inside the belly of a toad. It's not a good sound.
And he even joked about it in one of the discourses. In one of the discourses he said, oh my God, so there you are, you're sitting there, you're feeling uncomfortable, you're like, oh my God, when is this hour, or is this one an hour and a half, when's it gonna end? And finally, you hear me start singing again, and you're like, oh good, good, we'll be able to relax soon. Well, there were a couple of occasions, and most of them were the 4 o'clock in the morning meditations, mm-hmm. where you've been sitting there for an hour and 15 minutes, and he starts singing. And then the singing goes on for like a half hour or 40 minutes. Mm-hmm. Like every now and then there was something like that where you're just like, this is just deliberately trying to test my patience, you know?
You think that's part of it?
I don't officially think that that's the idea that he has behind the singing. But when you think about it, there really is something a little bit mystical about the singing, because... Mm-hmm. We can't understand a word he's singing. Right. So he says, oh, this is non-sectarian, et cetera, except that he's singing these sacred Buddhist chants that we can't even understand.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, there's a little bit of ceremony and mysticalness there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but there's no deity involved. There's nothing outside of yourself.
That's right. That's right. But they're definitely... Mm-hmm. is some, I wouldn't say dogma, but I would say strictures, right? Mm-hmm. He lays down that there's sila, samadhi, and panya. I think sila is your morality. Samadhi, I think, is your engagement with the world. Mm-hmm. And I think that's right. And I think panya is your practice, your meditation practice.
Did that aspect of it rub you the wrong way?
The sila part. Uh-huh. The sila part. You have to follow his quotations.
Yeah.
You have to vow sila at the beginning. And it's like 5 vows. One is you won't steal, you won't kill, you won't lie, you won't have sexual misconduct, was the way it was worded for our thing. Mm-hmm. And I took that to mean you won't masturbate or you won't have sex with anyone here. Mm-hmm. I did not hear the message, you won't have sexual thoughts. If I had heard that, that would have been a very, very fascinating change to my entire 10 days.
Well, the way I read it was, you're just cleansing yourself of all stimulation. We've taken in enough stimulation, so don't add anything else. No music, no books.
Right.
Sexual thought is all part of it. All these things that you take in.
Well, I think that, yeah, you're absolutely right. And that with all of those things, they're loaded with either craving or aversion. What you're trying to avoid at all times is something that gives you great comfort, or reacting to something that gives you great comfort, mm-hmm. or reacting to something that you fear or dislike, craving or aversion. You're trying to react to everything equanimitably. And so sexual thoughts are obviously
pretty much in there with the craving.
Yeah. I'd say so. Yeah. And yet, for me, like, so much of my identity and my persona out in the world mm-hmm. and my sense of self and all that sort of thing is tied up in being a kinky, sex positive, you know, let us have no shame about you know, weird proclivities and et cetera, et cetera. And
then it really pertains to you because it's all about shedding all that outside stuff and getting to your inner.
And it was perturbing to me because I found myself having sexual thoughts
mm-hmm.
a lot. Now, I think what I was really seeing was that I just naturally have sexual thoughts a lot. But when you shut everything else down, when you shut off all other stimulus, the ability to talk, the ability to read or anything like that, that was the place. That and fear of Donald Trump having just been elected president were the two places. And so that's interesting. It was craving and aversion.
Well, you weren't there over November 8th, right?
No, it was Trump had been elected, and then about a week later, I went on the retreat.
Okay.
So I had signed up for the retreat, assuming
yeah.
that I would be going in the comfortable, peaceful knowledge that the election was finally over and Hillary was going to be president, and I could relax and focus on other things.
They pretty much guaranteed that that session would be sold out.
Oh, my
or
God.
Filled since it's not on sale.
Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of the perfect timing. Great way to deal with it.
And I you know, it turned out I desperately needed it because mm-hmm. that week after he was elected, I was devastated and horrified, and you know, I mean, it was just so, it continues to be so, like, holy fucking shit, what does this mean? Mm-hmm. You know, what's coming? You right, know what I mean? Yeah. Especially because the campaign was so, went into such ugly territory that mm-hmm. we're not used to seeing people allow themselves to go in the modern political yep. Scene in America. So yeah, it was just very, 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 very frightening to me, and I couldn't get my mind off. I couldn't stop reading Twitter and Facebook and news and
while
bad
you were there?
News. No. I didn't have access to those things while I was there.
You left right. your phone behind and
yes.
everything. Great.
Yeah, you have That's to good. Hand your phone in.
So let's get back to this because we all crave, like, you know, everyday life is full of just cravings and cravings, little ones, big ones, whether it's career stuff, love, affection, a cigarette, whatever. So your craving that you found was sexually oriented.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you think about it as just a craving or just...
No, I would... You know, at first I wasn't really thinking about it at all. I was just like... during the first 3 days or so, I would find myself specifically thinking about the butts of guys that I've played with in the past, you know, few years. And
they would just pop into your head.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and that's just something, you know, that's everyone knows Kevin loves butts, you know. So that's I joke about it in my right. stories that's where my mind is apt to go. And indeed, here I was witnessing what happens to my mind when everything else goes away. And yeah, there's a habit pattern there.
See, I had just random stuff pop up.
Uh-huh.
Just random junk, pop songs that I hadn't thought about, just random lyrics. Very,
yeah. I saw that too, especially in the first few days mm-hmm. of yeah. like, you know, a lot of what pops into your mind doesn't even necessarily, it's almost like a dream where, you know, it's just like, I don't know why I'm thinking about that, but okay, you
back
know.
To, back to the breath.
Yeah, right, exactly. But no, after a while, I became pretty conscious of, oh, I fall back into thinking about butts mm-hmm. and sex as a sort of habitual pattern. And yes, of course, that's about craving. Of course, that's about comfort. That is... that's my happy place. You know what I mean? That's where I like to go, to feel, you know, it's almost like a security blanket sort of place to go. And so, yeah, there's a bit of an addiction to it. Mm. But at the same time, it really prickles my sense of everything to have someone telling me, don't think that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because that's how I was raised, very, very religious. And in Roman Catholicism, that's what I told myself for, you know, when I was 8, 9, 10, 11, you know, those years I was really struggling with being gay. Mm-hmm.
You went to a religious school and everything?
Oh, yeah. I went to a Catholic schools. My parents are still extremely Catholic. Mm-hmm. Very just immersed in Catholicism. And I was convinced during those tween years that I had to... Well, actually, really, even kindergarten, I remember thinking to myself, don't think that. Stop thinking that. You know, like, and having been trained.
But it's different because you were told to stop thinking because it was wrong. Because it's right. Like the devil's thinking inside of you.
Right.
Right. But here it's more, with the Vipassana, it's more about stopping every thought except for the breath.
Right, 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 right. Well, I mean, I think that that's a... I like that interpretation of it, but uh-huh. That wasn't quite what I took away from how he described Sila, or Sheila, as he pronounced it.
Uh-huh.
That the way he said it was, you have these things called sankharas in you, which are complected bits of energy that have to do with your deepest cravings and aversions, mm-hmm. and that... When you feel something especially unpleasant in while you're doing your Vipassana, it is those very sankharas, those little atoms of energy tied to your craving, your addiction to this, or your aversion to that. And they're trying to like burst out of you, and that's why they might feel a little bit painful.
I see where you're going. Yeah.
And you're trying to, according to Goenka, as far as I understood it, you're trying to break that chain. So he literally said, if you go out and do engage in sexual misconduct after the retreat, then fuck it. You've just destroyed all your work. You've just like added, you've added to the chain of sankharas, and they start adding up exponentially. And the idea is to purify yourself and get rid of them so that actually... giving up some of the stuff that you crave or are used to being so fearful of entirely is, I think, what his ultimate path was. Someone told me that if you want to do... Now, this might just be a rumor. Here's another thing about this retreat is everyone has very different experiences of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very different. So that's why when I talk about the retreat with people, like especially like I'll say it right here, right now in this recording, I encourage people to go because the way I'm interpreting it right now, mm-hmm. it might be very, very different from the experience that, you know, you had or that someone else might have.
Would there be anybody that you would say, maybe you shouldn't? Like you, like acid, you wouldn't recommend acid for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, officially, I think everyone could benefit from this.
Mm-hmm.
But
I think so too.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you're on psychotropic medications or.
I don't know if you would even be allowed to if you were on antidepressants mm-hmm. or stuff like. I mean, they do ask you that. I filled out that I did not say in my application that mm-hmm. That I microdose. You know,
mm-hmm. But you didn't do it while you were there.
No, I didn't do it while I was there. I took time off. But I did admit that I have done mushrooms and LSD,
sure.
and that occasionally I smoke pot, and that I used to drink alcohol, you know.
Which is probably most of the people there.
Yeah, I mean, for goodness sakes. What I was going to say was, someone told me, and I don't know if this is true or not, mm-hmm. that if you want to take the 20-day course, they literally ask you about your sex life, and that if you have had sex outside of a monogamous relationship within the past, I don't know, maybe year or so, you're not You're not clean enough to come into the program.
Really?
Yeah, that I don't know if that's true or not, but someone said that.
We should check and find out, because I know they offer 30-day courses, 60-day courses.
They offer, at the one, the Shelburne Falls one, there's a 30-day, there's a 45-day, and yeah, there are even longer ones in some places.
Imagine 60 days in silence.
It's crazy.
Was Goenka sexless?
No, he had a wife.
He did have a wife.
He had a wife, yeah.
So if he's having sex and he's the head of this whole thing, it must be okay, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's just that he is a, you know, the guy that you're seeing on the video is, whatever, 60 or 70 years old, and he's from Burma. You know what I mean? I mean, so this guy is raised in a very, very conservative, traditional, you know, if he comes from a place where sex is thought of from a very different mindset than, say, people of my generation do. You know, I'm a person who believes in open relationships and casual relationships. And
well, it's getting into the zone of, if it's none of your business and it doesn't hurt anybody else,
right,
what's none of your business, right? Why and try and dictate it,
right? I did so I think for me, like, what I'm always so fascinated with in myself is the struggle with the gray areas, and that is, oh, okay, so I have seen that this is a comfortable place for me to go back to all this sexual thinking. Maybe I can find ways to pull back on it or refrain from it or change some of the way that I have sex, you know, based on having looked at this, you know. Like, it did occur to me during my mushroom trip at the end, on the 11th day, I thought to myself, oh, I think I see what I'm seeing. It's that most of the sex that I have, I'm mostly, the volition, the thinking that I'm having is, ooh, let me have that, let me get that, rather than, ooh, what can the two of us create together, and what can I give to you? You know what I mean?
You're looking at it as a craving rather than a process of something.
Yeah, a co-creation of giving, right? Which is something you're much more likely to be able to produce within a more serious relationship. You know what I mean?
Right. If that's what you're looking for.
If that's what you're looking for. I haven't been in a real serious relationship in 6 years or so. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, it was just kind of very interesting for me to think, huh, when I next have sex, how might I be more mindful about the way I'm craving things and how I'm, the volition I'm bringing to being there with that other person and creating something together.
Have you thought, so are you looking for a relationship or open to one?
I'm open to one. I'm not actively looking for one. I'm 46 years old, and I'm just kind of at a place in life where I'm like, I don't know that actively looking for a relationship is, I mean, I guess it works for some people, but I, you know.
Well, because we're talking about craving.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's also, especially noticeable here in New York, where it could be such a playground, there's a lot of aversion. Aversion to intimacy.
Yeah.
Aversion to relationships, because that has to do with intimacy.
Yeah.
So that would be a question I would propose to you is, all right, you've noticed these craving of butts, but, and it's like, I must have them, but is there an aversion to a more intimate?
Yeah, that's a really, really, really good question. I think that there is.
Because the cravings are easy to notice. The aversions are a little more subtle.
What
we're trying to, you know, keep away for, maybe it's hard to be vulnerable, and you have to be vulnerable in an intimate relationship.
Yeah, yeah, and yes, you have to be vulnerable, and you have to give some of your own stuff up, you know, which was, you know, another thing that this course, you know, the course teaches you, oh my gosh, I have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. Oh my gosh, I have to sit in this uncomfortable position. You know,
well, that was the thing with me with the little cravings was, I'd be getting deep into the meditation, then I'd feel a little itch on my shoulder, or a little, and I'm like, do I scratch it? You're not supposed to scratch
it.
You just observe the itch.
Right.
And don't say, I have to scratch it. You just, oh, there's an itch there. Back to the breathing.
Yes.
And it always goes away without scratching it.
Yeah. Oh, of course. Everything arises and passes away.
Yeah. Which is, it's an amazing thing to notice.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But, and then I started to wonder, what are these little scratches that I think I need to address and little pivots that I think my body needs to do? If I don't do them, they go away. But why are they even popping up?
Yeah.
It's like little aversions to the meditation.
It's squirming. Yeah. Like for me, so I mentioned that 4 o'clock in the morning was one of my big breakdowns. Craving for butts was another breakdown. The third was...
You had guilt associated with the butt craving?
Yes, because shame around sex is just an issue of mine throughout my whole fucking life. Mm-hmm. And it really goes back to Catholicism. So here to hear sexual thoughts referred to within a religious or within at least a spiritual context was ringing some of those old bells for me, right?
Naturally.
Those two things I was struggling with. And then the other was, I asked for a chair on day one. Oh. Now, I hurt myself. I used to live just a block or so from here. I had a big bed bug crisis, and this was 3 years ago, was moving out as quickly as I possibly could, was just all traumatized by the bed bugs. And one day I was running down the stairs with a big box of tons of stuff and slipped and fell bam, bam, bam on my back down a flight of stairs and really hurt my shoulder. I still don't have full use of my shoulder. Was not aware, or at least don't remember being so aware that I hurt my back at the time, but I think I did, and I think I should still have the goddamn thing looked at. You know what I mean? So when I first talked to the assistant, because they call you about a week before the course to make sure you really are prepared to do this. Mm-hmm. And I said, I think I might need a chair. And he said, well, we really encourage you to try the mats first, but there are other seating possibilities that are available. He tried to be very vague about it, the assistant teacher.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
And so I went, and the first day I was squirming and squirming, you know, feeling that back pain, feeling that, and I have no ass either, with like literally like no fucking ass at all for ballast, which makes it hard on my legs and everything. Like, yeah, just everything is just, I don't have much physical endurance is what it boils down to. And so I was doing all that squirming you're talking about.
Yeah.
And I went to the guy and I said, I could really use a chair. Now, it's only 70-year-olds in the chairs on the side of the room, right? And then here I am, 46, and I'm asking for one. And he's like, I really need to encourage you to try a few more days without it. You know, if it's really horrific, you know, then we don't want you to not be able to concentrate at all. Mm-hmm. But give it another day at least. So on the third day, I came back and I asked for the chair a second time.
You did, okay.
And I got it. Now, it wasn't until a few days later and it wasn't until even really the very end that I realized, oh, when I started talking to other people, and when other people were able to start talking about their experience, I was like, oh, the pain from having to sit straight in one posture without adjusting it at all for an hour and an hour and a half is a big part of what makes Vipassana work or not, right? That, a lot of that back pain or that squirmy pain, you know, like you were just saying, you know, you want to squirm and then the squirming doesn't really seem to have helped anything because the pain would have gone away anyway. It's always arising and passing. So the squirming is just kind of a, I don't know, it's just a kiddish aversion reaction. And so, yes, I began to realize, oh, I lessened my experience by taking the easy way out, by taking a chair.
Did you end up giving up the chair on the...
I didn't give up the chair. I kept the chair the whole damn time. But my roommate did something very smart because he was also having serious back pain. He asked for a chair on the fourth day, but he asked for an option. So he had the chair and his mat in front of him. And most of the time, he chose the mat, right? And he was clearly going through more serious Vipassana experience than I was because he was facing pain and not falling back on back support, you know?
Yeah, but okay, so two questions. Is sitting cross-legged in the meditation pose good for your back or is it bad for your back?
I really don't know. And here's one thing that amazes me because I Googled this afterwards, after the whole retreat. There should be specific workouts for meditators to develop their butt and back and core strength for better sitting. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Core strength, definitely.
The thing of it is that it's weird. Some people, if they're sitting cross-legged, prefer to have their knees elevated a little bit. And some people prefer to have their knee, their butt higher than their knees.
Right.
So you'll see people with these, all these little mats and pillows, you know, creating little mountains and little, you know, like there's every, there's little stools, there's little back jacks, there's all kinds of things that people use. But me being in a chair, which I brought my the pillow from my bed and a couple of pillows to like, you know, like smaller pillows to really give the bottom of my back some back support. So I was sitting up straight and I was definitely feeling pain in my butt from just being tired of sitting all the time.
Even on the chair is just uncomfortable, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I did notice that the times I was most uncomfortable and just maintaining my awareness and my keeping on, you know, that's another thing you mentioned. You feel a tickle in your shoulder and it's really, you know, rattling you. And maybe it's you know, sometimes you feel a nerve go or something like that, you know, but wherever your awareness is on your body at that time, you're not supposed to leave there. You know, you're supposed to, if your awareness is on, huh, I'm not feeling any tickling or anything in my right shoulder. And then all of a sudden you get a stabbing pain in your gut. You're supposed to continue just focusing on, still not feeling anything in my right shoulder.
Well, you just go back to your breath.
Yep.
You go back to the breath and you might notice the nerve in your shoulder, but you don't assign it a quantitative feeling of good or bad,
right?
Uncomfortable. It just is.
Right. Right.
That's
right.
That's the hard, strange part, but it always goes away.
Yeah.
But I think if there is a way where you're sitting and it's detrimental to your back and you have bad vertebrae or something, like you can't ignore biology and physiology either.
Well, you know, Rick, the guy who was the assistant teacher, he was probably about 70 years old, and he said, I'll tell you what, though. I mean, I'd be a hypocrite if I he said, I have a bad knee and I use a chair myself and I meditate just fine. You know what I mean? So,
exactly.
Yeah. I mean,
they were probably just testing you out and make sure you just weren't being lazy.
Well, I'll tell you what, to a certain extent, I was. And I do want to do this retreat again. And when I do it again, I think I do want to ask for a chair again, but I want to do what my roommate did and also have a mat in front of me that I can use instead of the chair and choose the mat as much as I possibly can. I think if I did this again, it would be like a year from now, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe same time around Thanksgiving. And maybe between now and then, I can get used to a certain extent, you know, sitting out without a chair.
But the mind fuck part of it is that if you do have both, your brain somewhere that doesn't want to deal with the work of meditation will be like, oh, well, I'm uncomfortable now. I could just go get up and go in the chair, and that'll kill 15, 20 seconds, right? Because your brain plays tricks on you. You don't know if your shoulder is itchy or if you're just trying to not meditate, because it's so hard to just focus on your own breath, the most basic thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's all aversion.
Well, you know, like what's interesting to me about what you're saying is that when we were taught it, the way I understood it was that the breath, focusing on the breath, was just the first 3 days. Mm-hmm. And that after that, one was supposed to focus on the breath only if the mind got completely carried away and taken out of the meditate, you know, like all of a sudden you found, oh my God, I've been fantasizing about butts for 5 minutes.
You go back to the basic breath.
Right. Then you go back and then you get back into the Vipassana.
Yeah.
But my understanding was that for most people, like, you know, once we got to Vipassana on the fourth day, that most people were focused almost in, not returning to the breath, but were focused almost entirely on running that little frame of awareness over various parts of their body to feel the sensations. And eventually what happens, once you get really, really good at this, apparently, or really, really experienced at this, is supposedly, or for some people, you don't have any more blind spots, so mm-hmm. that you can run that frame of awareness over yourself rather quickly and just follow along this, like, almost like bubbling river of sensations going all over your body. And that from there, then you start going through the body. That mm-hmm. people can swish back and forth from left to right, from up to down, through internal organs, etc., and experience all these sensations.
My memory might be a little faulty because it's been a while, but did he talk about each little trauma in our lives or each little trouble being like a little blockage inside our body, and the meditation is kind of digging those out?
Yes. Yeah. That's what he meant by those like sankhara things. And I'm so new. Like mm-hmm. the one thing that I said to everyone on the day we could finally talk to each other was, I was like, wow, I'll tell you what, I am aware that I'm very new. You know, I don't feel like I went even as far into this as many newcomers do go mm-hmm. because of falling back on comforts and getting caught up in cravings and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But yes, he did describe these sankharas as being the blind spots or the deeply rooted problematic stuff in you mm-hmm. that, you know, if only you could just become more and more aware and go feel it and let it out and, you know, and be okay with it being released, you know,
mm-hmm. I've told us that story on this podcast before about my 6 day experience was when I had the childhood memory pop up, and it popped into my head as real as yesterday. It was like so clear, and it was something very bad, and it was something that I had repressed, and it popped up and I just saw it and I felt it. And I totally remember being a kid being in that situation, and just tears just started pouring down my face.
Wow.
And I had this urge, like, I have to talk to someone about this. I can't believe this. Holy shit, I can't believe this happened. That's right. Of course, I remember this. What the hell? How did I repress it? And that was my big epiphany for my experience.
Wow.
And I definitely felt like I was just digging in there.
And did you talk to anyone about it?
No, I just talked to my girlfriend at the time.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Was she on the retreat?
She was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, afterwards.
So you talked to her afterwards.
But it was, yeah, it was too messy to talk about it.
Oh, yeah. 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 That's fascinating.
I didn't talk to the people there.
Right, to the assistant teacher.
Yeah.
That's totally fascinating to me. And that is, I think, what most people kind of expect, that I mean, that's very literal, you know, that something's going to pop up, like literally kind of a repressed memory.
Mm-hmm. Nothing that didn't happen for you?
No, I didn't have memories of anything that I hadn't remembered in a long time or anything like that. Perhaps if I did it again next year, I would, you know.
I imagine so, especially if you keep it up even a little bit.
Yeah.
You'll just get deeper and deeper.
Yeah, yeah. It's a mysterious and fascinating and... It's a very interesting thing, and I hope that I can keep doing it and that I can keep going deeper, but that also I can reconcile for myself, you know, like as far as the whole butts and sex and stuff like that things go, I mean, I think everyone has their own definitions of what too much of this or this or that is. You know what I mean? Everyone, mm-hmm. like some people who have drinking problems, for example, actually can learn to moderate, you know, mm-hmm. or
some people can't touch it at all.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. So that I think that there are, you know, for like when you say sexual misconduct, like that's the way it was worded with us. I thought, well, one man's definition of sexual misconduct is totally different from another's, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So kind of, you know, learning from the material, but not getting too weirded out about being so specifically, yeah, still allowing myself the room to be me to the extent that I want to be me.
Well, I think with any practice, you have to, you know, massage a little bit so it works for you.
Yeah.
But I had a theme. I mean, just doing all the meditation, I would come to this theme of my existential part of being like, everything is pointless. What's the point of anything? This is how I felt when I did it, you know, over 10 years ago. Uh-huh. I think I might have changed from that person, but I used to be, and I'd be in the deep meditation and just be like, everything is sad.
Oh.
And like that kind of feeling kept coming up for me. And then the childhood memory popping up.
Wow.
Kind of just like, yeah. And I don't know if I'm like that. I don't know if that I'm that person anymore. But that was my recurring feeling that I kept having. I'm like, why am I just so, you know, at the bottom of everything, this is what it is, nothing?
Right. Well, that I've struggled with that in Buddhism too, that kind of, this spiritual concept that is sometimes thrown around, I don't know if this is the way they say it in the Landmark Forum, which is kind of stealing an idea that is kind of essentially Buddhist, which is, life is empty and meaningless, and it's empty and meaningless that it's empty and meaningless, right? So, you know, a lot of people hear that and they're like, well, that's kind of a bummer.
Yeah.
It feels like, oh, so there's nothing to really be passionate about, nothing to seek, nothing to, you know, make meaning out of or whatever. I think what that concept means is, choose meaning, you know, or create, you make your own meaning. Yeah
That's kind of a big thing that I got out of it.
Yeah,
was, well, I can say everything's useless and worthless, or I can be like, well, make it worth it.
Yeah. Now I'm curious, what happened to you after the retreat? Like did you keep meditating? Did you ever think of going back?
I thought of going to 3 days. I went to a 1 day that they had here in the city.
Uh-huh.
And I really realized I hate his singing. Oof. Because it wasn't... in the 1 day, it's not deep enough to be so tortured that his singing is a release or a relief. Boy, I practice it, you know, even just for 5 minutes at a time in the subway, just focusing on the breath and seeing if that'll take you deeper to the tingling and sensations of your body.
Mm.
I love it because it can be done anywhere at any time. I mean, I don't stick strict to it where I have to be sitting on the ground cross-legged. I'll do it lying down.
Yeah.
A lot. As long as I'm comfortable and I can keep focused on the breath and see where it goes.
He mentioned, actually, that in one of his discourses, he said, you know, if you ever have insomnia, that it's nice to just lay there and just kind of like go into some of the sensations and parts of your body.
Exactly when I use it the most, I would say. If I can't sleep or I wake up early, I'll do that. And then even if I don't get the sleep, my body has gotten the rest.
Uh-huh.
You know how Buddhists, when they meditate so much, they barely sleep?
Uh-huh.
It's a similar mind and body relaxation, I think.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you had a good experience from it.
I had a good experience, but I had a very challenging experience. It's, you know, the no talking, I had to laugh at first because the no talking at first reminded me of a Bergman movie.
Were you thinking about that during the meditation?
I was thinking of it whenever we had lunch because, you know, no one would make eye contact. There was just the clinking of the dishes.
You hear every little sound.
Yeah.
It's amazing how heightened our awareness gets.
Yeah, totally. And it just felt like, oh, someone has died and no one's talking to each other.
Yeah.
But I really didn't mind the no talking. What were the biggest struggles were 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, what happened was my big breakdown. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll talk about my big breakdown, and I'll talk about like a really hopeful moment in the whole thing. Mm-hmm.
I want to hear about this big breakdown.
It was on the eighth day. On the seventh day, I was, you know, looking around at everyone else at 4 o'clock in the morning and being like, no one's in the goddamn main hall. Everyone's choosing to do it in their rooms, which makes me suspect that everyone's actually asleep and not getting up at 4 o'clock in the fucking morning. So it was that voice in my head that was starting to get like resentful, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so on the eighth day at around 5 p.m., for some reason, I decided to try something I hadn't done the whole prior 8 days, which was to have a cup of coffee at 5 p.m.
They served coffee.
They have, it's mostly decaffeinated tea,
mm-hmm.
but they did have some green tea. And I would often have green tea at lunchtime, which has some caffeine in it, mm-hmm. but not much.
Yeah.
But they also had Taster's Choice instant coffee.
Mm.
So I was like, I'm going to treat myself on the eighth day. I'm going to have this coffee at 5 p.m., right? Mm-hmm. Then went into Vipassana for the 6 o'clock meditation, and then there's a 7 and yada, yada, yada. And those were especially intense because coffee mm-hmm. prickles at your entire central nervous system and starts getting all kinds of sensations going. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of an artificial Vipassana jump starter.
did it help you focus?
It helped me. Yeah, it did, but not in an artificial way, you know, not in a way that I'd recommend.
It stops you from going deeper into the subconscious, I think, or the unconscious.
Probably. It's maybe more just stuck on the sensations themselves without, I don't know. I don't know what my analysis of it would be, but the meditation was intense feeling. Mm-hmm. Let's just say it felt really plugged in and intense. And then his discourse that night was especially inspiring. And so on the eighth night, no sleep whatsoever. Not a moment of sleep. I couldn't get to sleep. So,
and that was, but the eighth night was when you had the coffee.
Yeah.
So maybe the coffee just kept you up.
Oh yeah. The coffee and the Vipassana that we did before bedtime and his discourse had just lit me up. And all of a sudden now I couldn't get to sleep.
So you just lied there for hours.
I just lied there for, from 9:30 and at 4 o'clock when they rang the bell, I was like, fuck it. I am not getting up. I'm going to continue to try to sleep. Like I had really, it was kind of a breakdown moment, not being mm-hmm. able to get to sleep that night. And so the ninth day.
Well, what did you do while you were battling the insomnia?
Well, I just kept trying to sleep. I mean, I even found that trying to do what he was saying, like going into Vipassana or whatever, mm-hmm. was, I don't know, I was just like, I was like, no, I don't want to do that. I want to sleep, uh-huh, you know?
Right.
So yeah, I was really having a breakdown that night. And the ninth day, I was like, It was that was like The Walking Dead. I had maybe my most amazing meditation that day because I was like, I was struggling against being so sleepy.
Yeah.
So I really had to focus to do it. And, you know, the one I did at like 1 p.m. or 2 or something like that was like a really, really good one.
But I could see how it can work to your advantage because you don't have the energy to fight the meditation.
Right. And you're using extra resources of energy to be there, you know?
Right.
And then, so all was good, you know, on the 10th and 11th day, I was fine and getting back up at 4 o'clock in the morning with everyone again. I couldn't believe they make you get up at 4 o'clock in the morning on the 11th day just to check out. But anyway.
Did you have any, because I remember I felt on the 8th or 9th day around there, I didn't want it to end.
No, I never had the sense that I didn't want it to end. Okay. I was very, very much like, you know, I'm
ready to get the hell out of there.
Yeah.
Was there anything you were craving? Like the first thing I want to do when I get out of here?
No, my mind was very much on, I want to get home and do mushrooms and see if that... gives me new insight into this whole experience. I didn't masturbate for the next few days even. Mm-hmm. You know, I kind of left that nozzle shut off for a little while to have some more time to think about that. And I'm still processing, obviously, you know. Yeah. The mushroom trip was really interesting. When I got home, you know, I fed the cat and spent some time with him. And then I was like, all right, let's do this. And at that point, it was like 2:45 in the afternoon. I was like, if I take a double, you know, like two of these little bottles of mushroom extract or whatever, it'll be like double a normal trip. And let's see what I get out of that. And
are you going to try and meditate on it?
No, I thought that might be a mistake. Mm-hmm. I thought that might be putting a hat on a hat.
Well, did you have activities planned for your trip?
No, I was just going to rest. I was just going to, like, you know, take it, lay back in bed, and see what occurred to my mind. You know? So I did. I took it. I sat upright in bed for a while, and then eventually I was laying down. And what was happening was there were these waves of pounding energy. It was kind of like it was coming from around me and inside me, and it was kind of to a beat, like I guess a heartbeat of pounding energy. And although I didn't hear a voice in my head, I still got this message that was coming out of this pounding. This pounding was... It was not upsetting.
Mm-hmm.
It was more like powerful. It was more like, you know, like
does it feel like a heart pumping, like your blood?
Yeah. Like a good powerfulness in this pounding. And the words I got in my head from what I was hearing, from not literally hearing but yet hearing, was peace is power. Was this message I just kept hearing, that peace is power. And what I kind of took away from it was this idea that be compassionate to yourself, be compassionate to others, rest assured that there's a middle way for everything, and that, you know, one can relax more and more about this craving or that aversion, and one can become more and more equanimitable and more peaceful, and that there's power in that, and that you can really thrive on that and flourish on that and do well with that. That's that'll guide you through.
I see. For me, I feel like there's a happy medium because, yes, it's great to do that and to be that and not let things affect you, to be like the rock that the stream flows over. But we don't want to be monks. We want to enjoy life and experience ups and downs and get involved in things that make us feel passionate. So you crave to be better at your art.
Well, absolutely. I mean, what you say is really interesting. Like, you know, one of my biggest heroes in the world of art is Dylan, who said, once you get to the place in your career where you feel like, all right, I'm content. He said, then you've lost it.
Time for a new career. Yeah, exactly.
I absolutely agree. I mean, you know, this morning, I opened my laptop and I was like, all right, I'm going to let myself look at a picture of a guy's butt for the first time in like, you know, however many, 15 days or so.
Is this like the next 10 days? Day four, I looked at butts.
And it was so funny because looking at this picture, I was like, oh my God, if loving you is wrong, I don't want to be right. You know what I mean?
Exactly,
so yes, there is a middle path. We don't want to be monks.
Exactly. But these are great tools to have.
Absolutely. To work your way toward less craving and less aversion, if not the perfection of being someone who no longer has sexual thoughts or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's just, yeah, the picture's falling off the wall. You grab the hammer and you nail it back on. You know, but then you go on about your day chasing butts.
Oh, shit.
So it was a good experience and you did get something out of it. I do sense that you're a little frustrated.
Oh,
or
no.
Still figuring something out.
Definitely still figuring things out. Okay. Definitely. That's. I just got through a session with my therapist where we talked about it for an hour and a half, and I wanted to come over here to talk about it because I'm still working with all this. You know, I've been sitting for an hour for the past couple of mornings and intend to do it regularly now.
So you're doing it a night one as well?
No, he says you should do an hour in the morning and an hour at night. And I don't know how that could fit into my lifestyle.
Yeah, I think an hour is a lot.
Yeah.
I kind of like the night ones better because it winds me down to sleep.
Well, you know, it's considering how things went on day eight for me, I'm not sure if that's true for me. But I did find one thing, and that is that my afternoon, my best meditations during those 10 days, and let's face it, like part of what happens during those 10 days is you've spent so much time meditating that you gain some ground that you almost immediately start losing when you come back to Earth. You know what I mean? Yeah, like there's, you've just, it's you're building that awareness of your body and your breath and everything.
But there's also no stimulation
exactly.
at the center.
Right. There's not all that much to distract you from it.
No, I felt myself lose it immediately. I was living in LA, got in the car, we hopped on the 101 and there's like five lanes. And I'm like, I can't drive and be this aware. I'm driving 10 miles an hour in the right lane. It's too much. Immediately your brain has to be like, can't handle it. Gotta block that out. Gotta block that out. Gotta block that out. Just so you can function.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That is, you know, the way that's a safety mechanism in our brain not to be taking everything in. And,
yeah.
You know, to focus on.
Especially here in New York City. It's like.
But I will say, I did mention that I wanted to mention one of my highlight moments. I think it was day six. It was maybe day five, but I think it was day six, where I was having a pretty good Vipassana meditation. Just, you know, the usual thing where I would come to, oh, not feeling anything in my shoulder, going to have to wait there for a while. And then, oh my gosh, my hand is really a lot of sensation going on there. You know, just to going over back and forth over the whole terrain. And
you know what? Before you continue, you might want to look into what emotions are kept in the shoulder.
Yeah. Yeah. And also this one, the one of them is a little bit injured too. So, you know.
Because we all store emotions in different places.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be very interesting to take a look at my specific blind spots and see if there's any news on those things. But in the middle, right in the middle of this particular Vipassana meditation I was doing, I would say like maybe 45 minutes in or 40 minutes in, something like that. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, there was this, what kind of, if it were to look like something, it would have looked like one of those fireworks in the sky that is, you know, a bunch of points of light that make a perfect circle. It was this tingling boom that went off throughout my entire body that just felt like bubbles of electric light inside me, like someone had just plugged in a Christmas tree, and it had this real like a firework, like this boom.
Was that feeling. A Sankara exploding? Like you got it?
What it was, what I took it for, was my mind and body letting me know that, hey, we know that most of your body is kind of hazy, that you're brand new at this, that you're outside your comfort zone and maybe too comfortable on a chair and blah, 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 all these things where you're thinking you're not doing as good as everybody else. Mm. But here's just a little taste of, if you kept doing this stuff, a sign that, yes, there are some serious sensations inside you. You know what I mean? Like, here's a little, like, preview of if you were to keep, you know, digging deeper and deeper, this stuff is within.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and you get those because you went from the breath to the feeling, the sensations in your body. Mm-hmm. So you do feel it get deeper and deeper.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was always, is this a pretty focused meditation, or is this a bit of a more hazy one where my mind isn't quite as, I don't know, there and really, you know, digging into it, you know?
Before you went, were you practicing meditation to kind of get in the groove of it?
I've been doing this app called 10% Happier, where for 10 minutes each day, you watch a little, or 5 minutes maybe, you watch a little video of a meditation teacher being interviewed by Dan Harris. Mm-hmm. And then for 5 or 10 minutes, that meditation teacher leads you on a guided meditation, you know, via audio. And it's kind of a smorgasbord because it's a different meditation teacher after every 2 weeks or so. So it's totally different styles. And so it's kind of a variety pack experience. So there's no way to do that 10% Happier app and get really deep into anything.
It's more like an introduction.
Yeah. I've heard so very many people say that if you really want to get into meditation, a 10-day retreat is just the sort of thing to get your feet on the ground, to at least get some experience so that you're, you know, your mind and body get, oh, okay, so we can do this, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're going to do a 3-day?
I do want to check out one of these 1 days that we do have in New York.
Yeah.
I don't think we have 3 days here. And I do want to do another 10-day, like maybe a year from now.
I did the last 1 day that was here. It was just like 8 or 9 months ago, I think.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, there's one coming up, actually.
I'll definitely check it out because I do want to keep doing this. I do want to keep digging deeper. I do want to keep also exploring whether or not I can build up the ability to not be sitting in a chair. You know?
All of the days of his speaking are on YouTube.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yes, overall, I would say I definitely had a very, very, very good experience. It was challenging in several ways that were very uncomfortable for me at times, but ultimately, I'm the better for it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Do you think you got more out of it than microdosing?
Oh, yeah, I would say so. I would say so. I mean, it's kind of hard for me to even quantify what I've gotten out of microdosing exactly. Mm-hmm. It's very, very subtle, whereas this retreat wasn't very subtle at all.
Yes. But did you notice thought patterns during the retreat?
Other than thinking about butts?
Yeah. Was that the main one?
That, and then going into fantasies that maybe once I got out, we'd learn that Hillary Clinton had, you know, been
right.
declared the actual president because of some electoral college snafu. Mm-hmm.
Fantasies, unfortunately. Yeah. What an interesting time to go into the retreat.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think you'll ever go again on a 10-day?
Yeah, I do. Uh-huh. Definitely.
That's great.
Yeah. And before I go, I want to just like really try to do the practice a lot and see if I can make a lot of good use out of the 10-day.
Yeah.
Like go when they're already warmed up.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good idea. Mm-hmm. That is a good idea.
Yeah. But it's hard. It was very difficult to adjust back to regular life afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very tricky.
It's... You know, one of the things I became very, very mindful of is that, oh my gosh, the amount of time mm-hmm. that I spend on Twitter and Facebook and then just reading news or whatever.
Taking stuff in.
Yeah. Yeah.
More than ever, we're just taking stuff in.
Oh my gosh. And it really, it's very addictive. It's mm-hmm. very, you know, the dopamine comes mm-hmm. from, you know, clicking on this, clicking on that, and you mm-hmm. know, dopamine comes out of, oh my gosh, what can I be outraged by now?
Well, if the goal is awareness, self-awareness, then that's the perfect drug for it, because to take you away from the goal, because it's constant aversion of self-awareness. You're just taking in more stimulation. Yeah. Oh, look at this, look at that.
Yeah.
It's tricky, because for me, I can't find the balance. Like, I feel like in my 10-day, I went too far where I can't function in life like that. You know, I couldn't drive in Los Angeles. I don't think I could walk down the street in New York City being that aware.
Right.
So I don't know the balance for me of like, okay, maybe somewhere around the third day is where I need to stop. Because then I could live my life.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I can't get that deep with it and then go out and just be like, everything's like a little dart. You know, it's too much to see. It's too much to hear. The noise is too loud.
Yeah.
The people, the suffering, the craziness, it's all too much.
Interesting.
So I need to find the balance of it. And that's pretty much what's been, besides the time devotion of 10 days, is like, I'm scared to go that deep again because I don't want to have the pain of readjusting.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
It was almost like when I went to Burning Man, it's like Burning Man was so... It was just all constant elation for those 7 days I was there, that when I came back, I got pretty depressed.
Oh, yeah. That's very typical, what they call con drop, you know, to come back from kink camp and stuff like that. You have the exact same experience of, oh, geez, now everyone's wearing clothes. And
right, yeah. It's almost like taking a drug. It's the high's not worth it if the low's just as bad.
Right.
I know. That's my battle with it. But I'm glad that it was good for you. I wasn't sure when you were coming here. I was like, I'm assuming it was good, but maybe it was terrible.
Well, you know, I wouldn't doubt it if that there are some people who go and take it and walk away and do feel like, ugh, that was mostly bad, you know? But I don't think so. I mean, that's certainly not the way that people were talking. You know, people were, once people were allowed to talk, there was kind of a gush of people expressing very different experiences. You know, I wasn't the only one who was like, oh my God, I feel like I'm a total newcomer and I've still got a lot of blind spots and it was kind of slow going. But people were still kind of like, I don't know, very fascinated and very thrilled and very like, this is really, really fascinating what we've been up to here, mm-hmm. you know? So, yeah, I mean, I think that even those who do have rough times with it at times, you know, people who break down crying because of this or that, or find themselves really resenting this part or hating that part, you know, the singing, the getting up at 4 or whatever it is, or the, you know, my back hurts, whatever it is, I think that most people probably come out the other end feeling like, oh, I'm better for having... Mm-hmm. for having made it through that. Yeah,
just the challenge of it. But I'm sure you saw people leave. Did you notice some people not be there on the third or fourth
day? Oh, yes. Well, people. I mean, I only noticed one person leave for medical reasons. But no, I think most people at... We had about 120 people. Mm-hmm. Maybe 130. And I know I was not aware of people leaving.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I noticed a few people that weren't there at the end that I noticed. But the only entertainment I provided myself was watching other people and trying to like give them a life, like a
personality. Oh, of course. Yeah. It's so funny because we all confessed to each other at the end that we had given each other nicknames.
Yes.
Some guy called me, he said I was the well-manicured Van Gogh.
Oh, nice. Yep.
Yeah, there was... It was so funny because they...
Have you been told you look like Van Gogh before?
I think, you know, once or twice, maybe. Okay. But I, you know, anyone... There's someone today just called me Chuck Norris.
Not as good as Van Gogh.
No. But they split everyone, men and women, right? There's supposed to be no interaction during the whole thing between men and women. So they separate the two sexes. And it's so funny because... The very first day, they sit me right. They put us in our places, and the person right in front of me is a 25-year-old gorgeous Asian guy.
Oh, no.
And I'm like, well, so much for splitting up the sexes,
right? Yep, you found a loophole,
right?
Well, I'm glad you had, did we cover everything?
I think so. Yeah.
I'm glad it was a good experience.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for recommending it.
I'm glad. Yeah, I figure, you know, worst comes to worst, if you make it through the whole thing, it was just a waste of time, which would be hard to believe.
Right. I mean, I don't think anyone could come out of it without at least feeling like, wow, that was really interesting to have done something so different. You know, I don't think anyone can come out of that experience without having spent a little bit of time with themselves in an off the beaten path sort of way, you know, like I think that a lot of us who do this retreat, you know, like I'm only a few days away from it now, I think I'll still be learning stuff from it beyond this day, you know. Yeah.
I started calling it probably the only real vacation I've ever taken.
Wow, yeah.
So, you know, you take vacations and you go places or you go on a tour or something.
Yeah.
You're always taking stuff in. But vacate your life.
Yeah.
No, so few rarely get to do that.
To step off the grid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's intense. We should do a 3-day together sometime.
Yeah, that'd be something.
Yeah. All right, well, thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.